Alright, when did you first get into music and what were you into?
Let's see, probably the first stuff here in Austin. I rehearsed and goofed around, like I said, with a band up in East Texas up there, and we only played a couple of parties, and then I came to Austin, and it was about 4 or 5 years before I got back into, like, the scene here, and I started out doing some plays, because I'd been in plays all through high school and college, and I got back into the drama scene here, and one of the first things we did was a big, giant bicentennial, 1976 bicentennial, anti-bicentennial, shall I say, musical that I had three songs in and sang in the chorus of a bunch of stuff, and that made me meet a tremendous amount of the art career weirdo musicians here in town. And I did that and did those songs with a troupe of musician actors here that had like a traveling troupe of, you know, people that would go around and do their shows at different places. And then they finally got a home base here in Austin. But I did that for about 3 years. And then punk rock and all that stuff was rearing its crazy head about 78. And I started going out a bunch then and jamming a little bit with a friend of mine. And then all of the skateboarders, which was Tim and Chris and Nathan, Chris's younger brother, and, you know, the whole slew of the crew of neighborhood crazies would all go out to the ditches and stuff, and I sang and yacked and yelled and made them listen to my poetry and shit. In about, September of 79, Tim and Chris both approached me that they were going to try a band, and this other thing with this other guy really wasn't working. So I went, okay, let's go for it. And, you know, they asked me to join a board, and we were like, you know, totally knew nothing about it. And Tim had played guitar, acoustic guitar before, and never really wild electric guitar. And Chris had played guitar in a high school band, so they had a bit of knowledge, and I had a bit of knowledge. And one of our skateboard buddies was a monster drummer already, and he was only like 18, but still like the total Keith Moon of Austin. You know, he was like totally whacked out on those first recordings. That single, you could tell how really good that drummer was.
That was Steve, right?
Steve Collier, yeah. So it was really cool. So we just clicked right off the bat, you know, and didn't know beans. I didn't know beans about music, you know, and I was trying, oh, God, where do I come in? Where do I come in? Do I remember all this shit, you know? But it took a while, and within like 6 to 8 to 10 months, we were starting to be a really pretty funky little band. And from the very start, you know, people always went, oh, they did funk and stuff. Man, we were funkity-funkin' before that band ever even began to start. Like, Chris was in a funk band. He loved Earth, Wind, and Fire, Cameo, the band he was in high school. They did funk stuff. I had already been singing funk stuff and grew up with it, because, like, that was, like, the radio station I listened to growing up. It was this wonderful black station from Tyler, Texas that just, I mean, I knew all that Otis Redding stuff. When I was in ninth, 10th grade, all of that was, like, right in my heart already, so that was part of me. And so when the big boys took off, we were just doing it because that was in us. It wasn't like something, oh, God, we're going to try a little funk with punk and maybe, like, make this niche. Nah, it was already there, you know. It just was what we were supposed to do. And it worked really good because we got the beat going pretty dang good pretty quick. And the fact that Chris's younger brother, Nathan, was a trombone player in McCallum High School in the 9th grade and 10th grade, and he got a couple of his buddies. And they made horn charts to those songs when they were in the 10th grade and would play like crazy clubs and have to, like, we had to get them in the club because they were underage, you know. Right. But we would play these great shows and play screaming, stupid, bad punk rock, and then play bad Earth, Wind, and Fire and our own brand of funk. Like, you know, probably we wrote at least 15 to 20 songs out of all those that had that, you know, funkity funk beat. So it was happening right off the bat, and people loved that. And you could tell the punks were, whatever, but then they start dancing and go, these are my roots. You know, I mean, I've heard all this. Let's get down. And that's where we gained a wonderful stature with the public, because we did not limit ourselves to what was like the properly little red label right then, you know. And we defied that, in fact, you know. It wasn't like a conscious thing to go, me and Tim are going to, like, defy punk rock today. You know, it was like, whatever we're doing is whatever we're doing. And it happened to be, you know, crazy punk rock one song and dissonant weird stuff with a bass guitar and a radio the next song, and something other where there were two guitars on the next song playing buzzsaw Van Halen, you know. So we were very, very happy and pleased with our lives at that time, to be getting to do something, to see a response from the crowd that made sense and inspired the heck out of us, you know. because it was my friends going, God, this guy had a great time. I'm going, I stood on stage and I saw people grinning from ear to ear because they were having a good time about something I was getting to help provide. And man, that joy is unreal. That is just so unreal to have that come to your heart by looking out on a sea of faces and seeing them really enjoying what you are. And you know, we knew that magic was there and didn't ever flaunt it, but knew it was there and knew that we had to be part of something, that we were a catalyst to provide that. And we, you know, I'm so honored to this day because of that, and I know the other people in the band are also. And we just got to be there at that time and be have our tiny little something get recognized where it helped out. It was cool. It was so cool. And gods of artists, people in Austin at that time, 40 bands at least to choose from, 3 clubs at least playing punk rock, and Raoul's open 7 nights a week with 3 bands a night, Duke's Royal Coach Inn open all the time with 3 and 4 bands a night. It was just wonderful, you know, and it wasn't all punk rock. It was all kinds of like bizarre, weird crap, just like I said, you know, because the rules weren't put into punk rock. You know, at that time, like from 79, 80, 81, and then it sort of got later on in like 82 and stuff, it got to where you had to like be this and be this, or you're not this, or whatever. You know, we got accused of that, but I always laughed. I didn't care. If you pigeonhole me, then I'll just like try to get me 8 more pigeonholes and make you even more confused, you know? So we did real good.
You mentioned that the owner started the New Wave Nights, and that's how you guys started deciding to try to like play the shows and everything like that.
Exactly. Yeah, because it was like a funky little Mexican conjunto bar on Guadalupe Street, which is affectionately known as the Drag in Austin.
Right, I've been there.
You know, and it was right there by the university. So there were a lot of people going over there, you know, getting beer and listening to weird wave conjunto night, you know, and they had some like a more up-tempo conjunto bands to where, you know, some of the white kids were going, like Salomon and a few others that were sort of crossover, but it was still pretty much a Mexican bar, even though it was right by the university, and friends coerced them to start having like new wave nights, you know, and that was an affectionate term back then, new wave, you know, God knows it was a very affectionate term, because it was not grunt country western as it's been forever in this city. So they had those nights, it started getting more popular, they were selling lots of beer because lots of people were coming. So they just devoted several more nights to it, and man, it just took over. And during the course of it, there were still nights, you know, that they would have some Spanish bands and stuff, but it became where it was like all just nuts punk rock. And, you know, beyond all the local bands, I saw like the Psychedelic First 2 nights in a row for $3 each night there. The Dills, the Offs, the Urinals, Elvis Costello was there, Dave Edmonds, you know, walked through the crowd. Patti Smith, I saw her in there. Black Flag played there, you know, early when Dez was still singing and stuff, even before Henry. And, you know, man, we were going nuts getting to see all this shit because it was like our heroes that you got to read in, like, the little fanzines from across America. And, my God, they were in our club in Austin. And moreover, I was getting open for some of them, so it was totally crazy. I couldn't have lived a brighter picture at that time in my life, you know, from what was happening for everyone. So it was really cool. And in some ways still is, but in some ways isn't that, you know, the stature of all that now.
What were some of the old school hardships you guys faced and the crap you had to endure, say, when you play shows or went on a tour or anything like that, or just with club owners and things like that?
Well, you know, you just never did make very much money, so that was one problem, especially if you went on tour. You had to really be careful to not, to be able to get to the next city. A lot of people... Oh, there was a, you know, great element here in the city that really loved us, but then there was like all the, you know, the cowboys and the frats and stuff that gave the punk rockers crap here all the time in the city. And, you know, I used to know people would get, you know, beat up, get their hair cut off and stuff like that. And big boys were like sort of, you know, raised a lot of stink with the frats because I made way too many posters that like just slapped them right in the face. You know, a lot of our posters would have like things against the frats. And you have to understand, back then, they weren't the kind of frats that are like, look like the Gap kids nowadays, you know, with a baseball hat backwards. These were like button-down collar asshole business guys that were like, you know, 20 and 21 and drunk as hell.
They're still assholes.
And they're still assholes.
Believe me.
They're still out.
I've been to the frat. I went to one frat party when I got here, and I was like, that's it. I'm not going to another one.
They still have the same mentality. They just have like those little Molary and curly haircuts. And
they're a little bit more laid back and somewhat more open-minded, but they're still assholes.
Right, exactly. Their values just still differ so much. And you know, most of the time we never really had too much problems with club owners throughout our career because we brought a element of fun with us most of the places we go. And most of the times I've heard people speak of us, you know, from other cities. They said, oh, man, you guys were so fun. So, you know, never too much problems with clubs, you know, in all honesty. One time in Houston we played a club, Spit. And it was called Spit, and we were going to play two sets. And the first set we played, and we fucking just wailed. It was so good. And I had on a big, giant pink formal, of like a 1950s women's formal, and had a big, giant wig on, and my red Vans tennis shoes, and all this weird shit, and was just throwing candy to the crowd and leaping off the stage out onto this big new wave barbed wire fence that they, or like a chain link fence they had sort of out in the club, and I ran and leapt off and scared the hell out of everybody and landed my big fat ass on this fence, and the club owners would not let us play a second set because nobody was buying any beer or mixed drinks. They were watching us, and we wrote a song later on called Spit that was about that, and that was all, you know, from a club owner point of view, that was one of the funniest things that ever happened because we made them so weird that nobody went to the bar to get anything. They were just watching us, you know, because we were crazy. And so they paid us, but we didn't get to play our second set. That was pretty wild, you know. Nothing too much. And played in L.A., played in Vexus, which was like probably one of the weirdest places I ever played in my life. I was scared. It was like in deep East L.A. That was pretty weird. And played in New York a few times at CBGB's, and that was always wonderful. And playing in places like Madison, Wisconsin. Maybe my very, very, very favorite place I ever played on tour was Madison, Wisconsin. And I'd never seen people, punk rock kids, together as much as what was there at that time. And, you know, cleaning up the club, mopping the club, working like crazy to get the club happen, which was literally an old church, you know. And they did so good. They did so good. And in my honored career of going out somewhere, I must say they thrilled me the most. We did real good and had a wonderful time everywhere we went.